From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at Berkeley not long ago, and a recent article in The New Yorker picks up the story, so I'll quote now. A team of researchers set out to design a robot that could fold towels. The machine they came up with looked a lot like Rosie, the robot made on the Jetsons, minus the starched white cap. It had two cameras mounted on its head and two more between its arms. Each arm could rotate up and down, and also sideways, and was equipped with a pincher-like gripper that could similarly rotate. The robot was supposed to turn a mess of towels into a neat stack. It quickly learned how to grasp the towels, but had a much harder time locating the corners. When the researchers tested the robot on a pile of assorted towels, the results were, from a practical standpoint, disastrous. It took the robot an average of 24 and a half minutes to fold a single towel, 10 hours to produce a stack of 25. End quote. Now, the lesson in this story is that while robots are being created to do remarkable things, there is a struggle to do some basic manual tasks. Fold a towel, maybe pick up the red block, not the blue block. And that leads to a set of questions. How can we create robots to do certain tasks better? And should we create robots to do certain tasks better if doing so could endanger existing jobs? Well, the good news is that there have been many predictions that technology would imperil the workforce. But so far, technology tends to also bring new jobs and opportunities. This hour in our monthly Science Roundtable, a conversation about what robots can do, what they can't do, and what we're teaching them to do better. My guests include the director of the Robotics and Artificial Intelligence Lab at the University of Rochester. He's a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the Department of Computer Science. Thomas Howard back on the program. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jake Arkin is here. He's a PhD student in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the U of R. Jake, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Michael Napoli is here. Mike is a PhD student in the same department. Mike, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Tom, I'm going to start with you just in terms of the broad speaking on what we can do and what we can't do and what robots can and can't do. And The New Yorker focused on trying to fold towels. And I think some people would be a little surprised at that because there are so many things that artificial intelligence, that robots do so well. Mm-hmm. Is this an example of what is still a big barrier, some of the manual dexterity, those kind of tasks?
Well, there's a few interesting elements of that problem that actually make it much harder than it would appear on the surface, right? So the representation of the towel itself, you know, how the robot thinks about the towel is not necessarily an easy problem. A lot of, you know, the, I guess, prime examples of how robots have been used out in the field tend to deal with objects that are rigid, you know, hard objects that I know if I grab it, if I pick it up, it'll, you know, it kind of moves in a nice, predictable way. Towels are tricky because they're soft objects. You know, there's a lot of interest actually in soft robotics right now that when you grab something, you have to predict how the whole thing's going to move. And if you pick up a towel, you can consider maybe the entire thing a single object. If you only grab the corner and you want to do folding, it's actually much harder. So I think we're embarking on a new area where we're removing some of these assumptions that have made, you know, robots out in the wild you know, effective but somewhat limited.
Yeah, and that story is just one example of how when we speak very broadly and draw conclusions that robots can do everything now, there's a lot of barriers, and we're going to be talking specifically about some of that. And Mike, I'm sure in some of your work, this is an example that those manual tasks. You know, what are the specific challenges that you see? What are the biggest challenges for robots?
Sure, yeah. So a lot of my research is largely focused in mobile robot motion planning. And so a lot of the challenges we run into are due to uncertainty. So there's a lot of environmental uncertainty when you go into mobile robots. And so, for example, you may be assuming kind of like a planar flat ground and all of a sudden there's a bump in the way. And so how you kind of adapt and how you kind of optimize towards that and everything, that's kind of where my work kind of falls.
Okay,
so.
Listeners, as I lecture Mike to get a little closer to his microphone.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. It's your first time in here. It's a little different than your lab. Listeners, if you have any questions or comments, this is going to be, I think, an instructive conversation about some of the work they're doing there in the lab and some of what may come out of it. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. I want to take a phone call early on a subject that I want to stress something here. You know, the three people in our studio today, it's a little unfair if we spend too much time asking them if their work is going to take away all the jobs of civilization. You know, to some degree, that's not their job to figure that out. Their job is to do the creation. But I understand the question. So I'm not going to dodge it, and they're not going to dodge it, but we're also going to spend the hour talking about other things. But on that subject, it's a fair question, and Bonnie in Rochester wants to lead off. So go ahead, Bonnie.
I actually wanted to say something about how this fits in with what is also happening in technology in general. Obviously, you know, there's agreement that certain things are kind of okay. But the problem I see is that if you put a lot of these issues together, globalization, robots, automation, climate change, there's really becoming more and more of a question. It's been raised a little bit. I wish it would have been raised before the election, about what is going to be constitute work. And I would add, what is going to be constitute work that ends up having still wages or having, you know, equity in you know, income. And there's proposals about guaranteed income. And I think while robots, you know, I think are a piece of that, and it's not the whole piece, I think it's a significant piece, because when you hear people interviewed, I've heard people say, well, we're going to be able to have robots do everything in next number of years. And, you know, and there's a thing just recently said 25% of the jobs that are now being done by people will probably be converted to, you know, either through automation or robot or something. So I think the context of this is very important. And also, I'll end by saying the question, I get a little disturbed when I hear people in these fields saying, well, we're kind of in a bubble of our own. We really don't have to be too concerned about how the outcome for the general society is. I have a lot of trouble with that. I think it should not be less in that way. I think we have to ask those questions as we go along. So,
okay,
so thank
you. Thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. I'm going to let them all kind of weigh in on just how much they think about those questions, and I think those are fair. Let me also tell you that if you want to check out a longer form article on the question on these matters, there's a number of books that have just come out, and the New Yorker sort of did a kind of a review of that. And I kind of cited that at the top, but let me just read one little section that relates to what Bonnie says from the article in the New Yorker called Our Automated Future by Elizabeth Colbert. Quote, the question, how long will it be before you lose your job to a robot, is taken up by a number of recent books with titles that read like variations on a theme: The Industries of the Future of the Professions, Inventing the Future. Although the authors of these works are employed in disparate fields, law, finance, political theory, they arrive at more or less the same conclusion. How long? Not long. Martin Ford, a software developer, asks early on in his book, Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future, quote, could someone become proficient at repeating the tasks you've already completed in the way that a student might take practice tests to prepare for an exam? If so, then there's a good chance that an algorithm may someday be able to learn to do much or all of your job, end quote. And a computer doesn't need to replicate the entire spectrum of your intellectual capability in order to displace you from your job. It only needs to do the specific things you are paid to do. That's from The New Yorker. Tom, how much are you thinking about those issues?
Quite a bit, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of the things we actually spend a lot of time working on in our lab is human-robot teaming. One of the emphasis, one of the major points of emphasis in our lab is natural language understanding, so we can actually communicate, you know, to and from robots. So robots can both ask for help when we need to interject so it can do tasks, and also so we can communicate to robots what we want them to do. One of the major things we're doing is working with, you know, a robot torso in our lab and being able to, you know, do cooperative tasks. So I guess the towel folding experiment might be a prime example of this, right? A person could do this very quickly, very easily. You know, certainly can beat out a robot. Robots are very unlikely to be replacing people doing those kind of, you know, higher intelligence, more precise, more kind of experience-based tasks, whereas, you know, robots are very good at transporting things, you know, doing things which are more monotonous. So, you know, it's certainly true that, you know, jobs will change. Technology has impacts on these things. You know, certainly we don't do things the way that we did, you know, 40, 50 years ago. But I don't think it's going to be done in isolation, you know, independent of humans. I think it's just, you know, they're going to be more cooperative, and that cooperation is going to be much more transparent to everyone.
Okay. Mike, how often are you thinking about this issue?
Yeah, I do think about it. It's one of those things you have to kind of consider. But I do think that robotics is, I like to think that at least that we, it can be assistive, right? And so the idea is we want to put robots in places where we don't want to put people. And so I think keeping them safe is kind of what I try to think about when I work in this field and everything. So I try to think that we're doing good by building systems that can save lives.
Okay. So, and Jake?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important question. And it's something that I've been trying to get a good understanding of. but in general, I tend to agree with Mike and that I focus more on the opportunities for robots to collaborate with humans or displace human jobs that may be risky, so perhaps working on an oil rig or something like that. There are other opportunities where robots can be rehabilitative, for example, some sort of assistive medical device or a prosthetic, something along those lines, where it's less focused on the job aspect and more just improving quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For a long period of time, you know, there was this description of dirty, dangerous, and dull of things that robots are really good at doing. There still is often a human in the loop, even when you have teleoperated robots doing these tasks, right? So if you imagine, I guess thinking back to my time at NASA, you know, we've sent robots to Mars to do scientific exploration. It was much more cost effective, much more safe for them to do those initial surveys before people, you know, get there in the, I guess, next n number of years, right? So there's still humans that are a major part of those activities. It's just robotics and robotic platforms are tools to help people do what they need to do.
Sure, and I will also just add, you know, Bonnie brought up the idea of basic income. We did a whole program recently on the UBI, the Universal Basic Income. This question on automation came up, understandably so, and a couple of our panelists from the Center for Governmental Research expressed some concern that we may be entering a different era. Elon Musk has said the same, whereas our guest, who is a professor of economics at RIT, Amit Badabial, said that we've heard this sort of crying wolf many times, the creation of an automobile and the carriage makers and textiles and printing press, and that we haven't seen the kind of displacement at the levels that have been often predicted going back decades or hundreds of years. It's possible, but he doesn't suspect we're there now. But Bonnie, I think it's a fair question. So I'll just leave it there. And if you want to learn more about a universal basic income, check out our podcast. You can see previous stuff on that. Jake writes to the program on the subject of what robots can and can't do. And Jake is a regular listener of avid interest on the science programs. So I don't know exactly what Jake does, but it's something very sciencey. Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't know. I'm not going to try to be the guy who's the expert. But Jake says, I just want to point out robots have no problem with manual dexterity, and they can pick and place objects at any angle and location down to sub-millimeter accuracy. The problem is tactile feedback and vision systems. There are videos out there of quadcopters balancing and throwing 3-foot sticks on their end from one to another, but it only works in a special room where there is advanced motion tracking, end quote. So I think Tom and Mike can kind of jump in on, is Jake on the money here? Is he right?
Well, I mean, certainly it is true that, there's lots of examples of industrial robots that work in very controlled environments that can do very precise things. And they're very specific platforms designed for those very specific tasks. I think where we're going, and particularly a lot of the work we do in our lab, is not about a robot to perform a single task. We're really interested in trying to develop platforms that can do many things. People do many, many things. As robots advance, they're going to, be more like people and be more flexible. I imagine it's actually quite expensive to change over a process where you're manufacturing some small object. It would be nice if you can actually roll in there and just have the robot figure out how to modify that assembly by itself. In the case of the quadcopters and things, yes, there's been lots of, very exciting quadcopter videos flying around. And a lot of them do have the little motion capture tracking system. When I was at MIT, we were doing the same. It is true that robots understanding where they are in the world and understanding what the world around them looks like is a major problem. A lot of robotics now deals with how do you reason on a mathematical level about uncertainty and how do you make decisions for that? And in fact, both Mike and Jake both deal with this problem of, given some uncertain idea about what the world looks like and what we want to do, how do we choose how to move the robot? Because there are consequences for doing it wrong.
Okay. Mike, you want to weigh in on what Jake said as well?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I agree with Dr. Howard pretty much exactly. I don't want to say it's easy, but things can work very well in a controlled environment. And then once you get into the wild, it's a lot more difficult. And so I think, and as I kind of said before too, I mentioned there's this uncertainty when you go out into the wild, and that's kind of what we deal with. So again, like Dr. Howard said, if you don't figure out where the robot is, for example, is one of the problems I'd be dealing with. We call that localization. And being able to react and choose what you want to do depending on where you think you are, it's actually very challenging. And so that's just, one of the examples of kind of the challenges that we run into when I'm doing like my kind of work and everything like that.
Mike was actually the TA for a new class we taught at U of R last year called Autonomous Mobile Robots. We taught students kind of the end-to-end perception mapping, navigation, state estimation problems. So in the end, students, some of the students were able to get a robot to drive around an obstacle course by themselves. And dealing with uncertainty is the main thread behind that entire thing. So, as Mike can tell you, you tell the robot to turn a certain degree and it does not move quite as you expect. So using that, visual feedback or inertial feedback is really important.
We're talking about the future of robots and the work being done at the Robotics and Artificial Intelligence Lab at the University of Rochester. Dr. Tom Howard is the director of that lab, and Jake Arkin and Michael Napoli are PhD students who are working in various capacities. And in a moment, we're going to turn to Jake to talk a little bit more about the work of sort of understanding the human voice and the kind of interactions that will open up possibilities for robots. I want to hit a question from a listener first. Ellen just writes to the program and says, there's a lot of talk about robots, what robots should and shouldn't do. What are your guests working for? What are the tasks that they want robots to be able to do? And I think what Ellen is asking is, if you guys are successful, what comes out of the lab and what are the changes here that we'll see?
So a lot of the emphasis in the lab are ways to do cooperative exploration, cooperative mapping, and things like cooperative manufacturing. We have an NSF-funded grant on verifiable natural language interaction. The idea is, you have this robot sitting across from you. You're telling it what to do, and if the robot understands it's not actually able to, fasten these two objects together or which objects you're talking about, the algorithms you've actually been working on are smart enough to actually interject, which is actually some of Jake's work.
Do you want to tell us about that, Jake?
Sure, yeah. I guess to be a little more specific on the exact application that I was looking at, the idea was to have a dialogue interaction scenario where the human could tell the robot to do something. In this particular case, we were organizing colored blocks into different bins according to the color. but there can be circumstances where the human tells the robot to do something, but the environment doesn't reflect what they said. So their instruction doesn't make sense given the context of the environment. So for example, you might say, pick up the blue block on the table, but maybe the table's empty, or maybe the robot can't see the block. So from the robot's perspective, this question or the instruction that you've given it doesn't make any sense. And so there's at this point, you can consider what should the robot be doing. And so what I've been working on is providing it with the capability of generating a question in relation to the instruction that you provided, which will help it fill in the missing information and make the formerly unachievable instruction now achievable. So, for example, with that blue block scenario, there may be no blue block on the table, but I tell it to pick up a blue block. And then it may ask me a question, will a blue block eventually appear? And then I can say yes or no. I can provide some sort of feedback that allows the robot to anticipate what's going to happen in the future that will make that instruction feasible. So I guess the idea there is, talking more generally, kind of with Dr. Howard's examples, in more complex tasks like in a household setting where you are cooperatively preparing dinner or something like that, maybe the robot doesn't have the precise manipulation to chop up the carrots for the salad, but you told it to chop up the carrots, not knowing that it couldn't do that. It analyzes the question and then replies and says, I can't do that. Can you do that? And then now you're having this dialogue interaction in a cooperative dinner preparation scenario.
An important part of that, too, is, it's not encoding, question-answer type things. A lot of the algorithms we're developing are data-driven, so we use a lot of machine learning to try to actually learn what this is. So if we teach it some concept, if we have a bunch of data, that it can use to reinforce this concept, the goal is to be able to get the robot to extrapolate to scenarios we haven't had it explore. That's actually where we're, where we're kind of going.
Sure.
There's no way we can pre-encode everything.
Sure. And the chopping carrots, my brain goes to dark places. Forgive me, Jake, but I can't be the first person to ask you this question. But this is an extension of the concern that I read in the most worst-case scenario books about artificial intelligence, which is that I think it's one of two things. A robot will be given a task, and it will be so consumed with doing that task that it will pose a risk to other things, If you instruct it to chop up the carrots, it can chop up the two carrots on the table, and then there's no carrots left, and what's it going to do?
Sure.
Does it realize it is done with the task? Does it look for other carrots? Does it chop whatever is the most carrot-like structure around it? I mean, and again, we're talking about chopping, but we're talking about any task that a robot's programmed to do. What does it do to continue to try to achieve whatever its programmed goal is? And does that potentially lead to some bad outcomes? So I think, how do we make sure that, you know, the outcome is understood, achievable, and doesn't sort of get out of control?
Sure.
This is a dumb question, isn't it?
No,
I'm being very
patient
with the host.
I think it's really important to understand the implicit information of the command, right? And that's actually one of the big things that we learn from all these examples, because we have people go through and, you know, kind of describe what's going on in scenes. But there's a lot of other things that are going on under the hood. You know, if you say chop the carrots, you know, there are implicit restrictions or constraints to not chop other things in the scene, to stop when there are no carrots left in the scene. You know, we have these examples where you pick up blocks and put them in boxes and things, but there's all this implicit information about not slamming your elbow against the table and all these other things which are important. So the robot understanding when it can and can't break these constraints is actually key to this.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Jay.
Well, there's actually interesting work from Cornell that was focusing – I brought up the carrot example in particular because mm-hmm. of this. the idea was to use a reinforcement learning algorithm, which is where after a given action, you either give the robot a positive or a negative feedback response to tell it that it did something good or did something bad. In this particular case, it was a kitchen scenario, and the robot had to turn around to get the carrot and then turn back around to the other table to do the chopping. So the point of this experiment was to then reinforce how the robot is holding the knife while it's doing that actual rotation. And so the idea was to teach it over time that it should value pointing the knife away from any humans over almost anything else. So it was prioritizing the safety of the human in that particular case.
How interesting. Yep. And Mark writes just on this subject here. He says, Evan, I assume there will always be a stop command, whatever the task is. Is that true? Is that right?
I mean, certainly there are in our platforms. Yeah. I think there's always an assumption that, you know, there is some level of human supervision in most of the things that we're dealing with now. I think, you know, I guess I won't speak quite to the future of it, but right now, you know, everything kind of has a human in some sort of a supervisory level or some sort of interaction.
Yeah. So whatever the task is, moving boxes, packaging materials, cutting carrots, that you would hope that it wouldn't be such that you could even get to a point where there is a total lack of control, that whatever the robotic creation is not responding to any sort of a stop or cease, et cetera, right? I mean, that's just
I mean, makes good safety sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the kind of industrial robot case, you know, certainly you have machines that there may be a higher level kind of stop, but, you know, those systems normally operate within you know, these restricted areas that people aren't allowed to go in.
Okay, so. I see the phone's buzzing as well. So let me start to get some of your feedback and questions for the panel. And, I think this went to the junk folder. Oh, sorry. I'm going to look at what the host did. I was ready to read a question, and it got redirected to my junk mail folder, which is a terrible thing. So I'm going to take a call first. Bob in Lyons. Go ahead, Bob.
Just curious about what the panel thinks about DARPA's efforts to create a fully autonomous drone.
I'm sorry, a fully autonomous drone.
A fully autonomous drone. As mentioned in a news report on NPR a few months back.
That story, according to producer Megan Mack, is the FAA expecting 600,000 drones to be used commercially within the next year. The FAA forecasting there could be as many as 600,000 unmanned aircrafts used commercially during the first year after the rule is in place. And FAA Administrator Michael Huerta said in a press conference, quote, drones are helping to create a whole new means of realizing the American dream. Is that what you're referring to?
No, I am not. I'm referring to DARPA's efforts. DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Products, something. Military research, fully autonomous drone.
Okay. Dr. Howard, you want to start? I'm not all that familiar.
Sure. I mean, I don't know if I know the specific program you're mentioning. I guess full autonomy is still, to my understanding with those types of things, still has a human in the loop. I don't think it's going to be, you know, set off like a bird and then kind of off to the wild. Certainly systems that know how to navigate beyond kind of waypoint level control would be interesting. I mean, that's an interesting research question, and certainly, you know, lots of organizations are interested in trying to deal with the more general research questions of how do you get systems to operate in dynamic, uncertain environments with minimum computation and unmanned aerial vehicles. The more common name for drones in our field is a great platform for this. So,
okay. Let me grab another phone call, and this is Charlie in Honeyway Falls. Go ahead, Charlie.
Actually, Seneca Falls.
Oh, Seneca Falls. Go ahead.
How applicable are the Asimov's three laws of robotics? Is that something that's totally fantasy, or can that be made part of the whole underlying command structure?
All right, so hold on, Charlie. So you got to give us the three laws for those of us who are not up to speed with the three laws.
A robot may not injure a human being or through interaction or inaction allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey the orders given to it by a human being, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And the third law, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protections do not conflict with the first or second laws. You know, I'm a sci-fi guy for 60 years now. That was written back in probably the early 50s. So how prescient was Isaac Asimov, or how real could that command set be made?
Go ahead, guys. What do you think?
I'm familiar with the three laws of robotics. And in general, I think it's a reasonable hierarchy of control. And it establishes that the human is the creator and is the master of the scenario, right? That's the idea behind those three. As for the specific question into whether or not we would specifically implement those as a control mechanism, it seems like they're very vague, and most systems nowadays are very application specific. So it's much more likely that in existing systems and maybe even going forward, you'll just establish different types of control laws, but fundamentally the concept they're going after, which is reinforcing that human is the person giving the commands and that the human safety is prioritized over everything else, I think is fairly consistent.
Okay. Mike, you want to add anything there?
Sure. I mean, I pretty much agree with Jake there. I think the notion of human safety is the primary thing. But again, it's very vague, right? So, and what if you have a scenario where there may be two people in danger, and how do you figure that out, and how do you use those laws in that context? So, I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good kind of, you know, jumping off point, but I think specifics are probably needed if we're going to implement anything like that. So,
the one thing I'll add is I don't know if Asimov thought that much about uncertainty, right? So certainly those laws apply well if you know everything universally true in the environment, and that's a big problem for robotics right now. Trying to, you know, be absolutely certain that the object you're picking off the table is something or another vehicle on the road is actually moving. Certainly lots of people are working on trying to reason about that uncertainty and do things about it. Maybe we'll get to that point where it's kind of like the verifiable language interaction work we've done in the past. But we'll
yeah, see. I was actually going to comment on that. You can imagine a scenario where the robot is aware that the human doesn't know certain things, and so the human might tell it to do something, but rather than just strictly obey as those laws might imply, there's an opportunity for a dialogue there where the robot and the human can talk about some goal that they're trying to achieve together, and the robot may have some valuable input rather than just explicitly obeying the instruction.
Yeah, robots that can both reason about and act upon the uncertainty that they observe, that they know that they're not certain about something, I think is really important and really essential if you really want them to go out and work in the real world, sure. Away from, you know, graduate students and other things.
How close are we to achieving that?
I don't know. Certainly, you know, you're seeing isolated progress in certain subfields. More of these, you know, the mobile robot community is working more with the unmanned aerial vehicle community, and, you know, the manipulation folks are working more with other areas as well. I think we're moving towards it, but I don't know. I don't have a timeline.
Okay. So if you're just joining us on our monthly science roundtable, as we talk about the work happening in the lab at the University of Rochester, but also in the field at large when it comes to robots, it doesn't sound like right now, if your job is working at, for example, Banana Republic, it's going to be hard for someone to come replace you in folding clothing and interacting with people. There's going to be hard for a machine to come do that for a number of reasons. The texture, as Tom said earlier, robots do much better handling things that are harder surfaced, right? Mm-hmm. And look, progress is amazing. Eventually that may change. But right now, That's where the state of the field is. But there's a lot more interesting things that are happening. And that's what we're discussing with our guests. We'll take more of your phone calls, get more of your questions that have come in via email with our guest, Dr. Tom Howard, who is the director of the Robotics and Artificial Intelligence Lab at the University of Rochester. And Jake Arkin and Mike Napoli are PhD students in the department, and they are here to answer some of your questions as well. So we'll get back to those phone calls and questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, I'm joined first hour by the CEO of WXXI, Norm Silverstein, along with Neil Shapiro, President and Chief Executive Officer of WNET, and Michael Oreskes, Senior Vice President of News and Editorial Director for NPR. We're talking about fake news, how to combat it, and spot it. And then in our second hour, our coverage of Governor Cuomo's State of the State regional addresses. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Chris writes to the program and says, robots won't be successful in the world until they can do housework, vacuuming, washing dishes, doing laundry, dusting, etc. Please read Robert Heinlein's Door into Summer. If there were house cleaning robots, whoever invented them would be very, very rich. That's from Chris. Megan Mack points out that through, I think, CES, Tom, is that the term? Is that CES, Meg? Yeah, she's saying yes. What is CES, by the way?
The recent Consumer Electronics Show.
Consumer Electronics. There you go. See, what do I know? Again, very little. That's what we've learned in these 2 hours today. Through the Consumer Electronics Show there, there's an integrated with image analysis, AI and robotics as its core technology, a refrigerator-sized device called the Laundroid. It not only washes and dries clothing, but tries to fold them, potentially replacing the ubiquitous washing machines at home. Laundroid. Hmm. See, I don't, Tom, is that the kind of thing that, you know, should that be our priority? I mean, do you agree with Chris that home tasks are a priority? Maybe.
I actually do think that you know, home is one great area for assistive platforms, right? Certainly, you know, as people age, they want to remain more independent, and they're a great way to do that. I think with the Laundroid case in particular, I think that's an example of kind of an isolated platform to do one focused task, right? We tend to think about robots in our lab as we want platforms to do many things flexibly, as opposed to kind of an integrated appliance for a specific task.
Okay. You guys want a Laundroid at home?
Yeah, actually, that sounds nice, right?
Pretty great.
We'll see how it does the folding there. On our phone lines, we'll go back to your calls now. In Brighton, this is Andy. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi there. You've had two callers that raised interesting questions. One had to do with autonomous drones. One had to do with Asimov's three laws of robotics. By the way, the three laws of robotics and all of the ethical and uncertainty questions were raised in his book, a series of short stories about how those three laws would interact in a device. But the reason I called is the idea of an autonomous vehicle, whether it be a car, a drone, or some other vehicle, not just simply a single-purpose robot that's designed for a specific task, but a general-purpose, artificially intelligent-driven device like an autonomous automobile, which is very close to being real in our existing world, is going to have to deal with these questions. And perhaps one or more of you is familiar with the philosophical question called the trolley problem and how an autonomous vehicle would deal with a dangerous situation and have to make a decision whether to protect its occupant or perhaps a bystander. I'll leave that open for discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Go ahead, gentlemen. Tom?
Yeah, so certainly, you know, I've had my fair share of experience with autonomous vehicle work when I was a graduate student. I spent a lot of time working on things like the DARPA Urban Challenge and, I guess, logged many miles in the back of self-driving vehicles running my motion planners. I am familiar with the trolley car problem. The issue with the problem is, you know, do you hit, you know, a certain set of bystanders, or do you save yourself, or these other, you know, other things as well? I think what we're seeing now, there's a lot of emphasis on not robots that completely operate independently and people are sitting in the back and kind of not paying attention, but how to make it more cooperatively safe for a human driver. A lot of people who have discussed that problem recently in, conferences and other things, when I've heard about this is, that's one where you're going to hand over the problem back to the person. A lot of the driving is easier to automate, right? A lot of the highway driving, there's lots of examples of people doing that. In the corner cases, the 1% of cases that may be tricky for a robot to really handle, the robot is more a cooperative system that works with a person as opposed to kind of an isolated, entirely independent system.
Okay. You guys want to weigh in on the trolley question? And yeah, Jake?
Sure. I mean, I think when thinking about what autonomous vehicles are going to look like 5 years from now, if you try to impose a solution to the trolley problem, I think you're kind of misrepresenting what's really going to be happening. So the cars themselves, while they may be able to communicate with each other looking forward in the future, there's actually still going to be a lot of uncertainty in that problem. So perhaps the situation is you could collide with one vehicle or another vehicle, but in that case, you don't know the occupancy of those vehicles. So there may be one that has more people than the other, but you are unsure about which. So I think that the ability of the robot to even reason about that problem is a little further away than the question was really implying. So because of that, it's personally, I tend to think more along the lines of what Dr. Howard was talking about in what are some sub-problems that we can solve very quickly now, and how can we just make the human an overall safer driver? So kind of more of these assistive technologies rather than fully autonomous.
Tom, given your work on driverless vehicles, mm-hmm. and given the, I don't know if hype is the right word, but there's a lot of discussion in the media about what Uber and Google and so many other companies have been trying to do with it, and yet also the way the media just descends on any single accident, fatal or otherwise, mm-hmm. to sort of cast this pall over, the lack of safety. I've asked this before, and I'm just going to kind of keep asking it. Are we going to be able to decide as a society that human beings, we're not very good at driving cars? I mean, overall, something like 30,000 people die in accidents every year, and we text and drive, and we eat and drive, and we fall asleep, and we drive drunk. We don't do very well overall, I think, driving cars. And if we had a scenario where so-called self-driving cars were more effective at safely transporting us, but had some non-zero number of accidents and fatalities, would we be able to accept that that is part of it? Because if it went from 30,000 to 1,000, that's still 1,000 people who are going to want to sue those companies and deal with this. I don't know that we're ever going to kind of cross that threshold of being able to kind of grapple with this as a society because of those 1,000 or whatever X number cases people are going to be fired up about. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's certainly a tricky loaded question, right? I mean, I think a lot of people in our community as well still want kind of a person in the loop. There still is this level of human cooperation and that final decision of, whether to go left or right when there's no good solution, should have some influence by a human. But I don't know. I mean, at this point, I think we're far enough away from robots really being able to represent the world as accurately as it needs to that it becomes simply a question of ethics or logic.
Martin writes to the program and wants to know in regards to handling hard objects. Your guests have been talking about blocks and things like that. And he says, I've been reading that certain companies, Amazon among others, are using robots to handle packages, move them throughout warehouses. Are we seeing more of that? And does their work impact those kinds of fields? Tom?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, Amazon, has made great strides in trying to automate warehouses, and that is a good example of a cooperative human-robot task, because it's not a lights-out factory that robots are just doing all these things. They're working cooperatively with people to move goods, and humans are solving kind of the hard, dexterous problems. Amazon often, them and others sponsor these manipulation contests at conferences where, you're given a bin of objects and you kind of have to sort it through a manipulator and do these things. And what we discover is, there's really hard problems that still need to be solved there. So I don't think it's not like a year and you're going to flip over and then, it's just going to be robots throughout the entire factory. I think, the human element is still going to be an important part of this. Human robot teams are still going to be an important strategy for doing these kinds of things. But But yeah.
Are robots getting better at recognizing which package or series of packages to move and how to differentiate and make sure that they have what they're supposed to have? And is that part of this process?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it certainly, you know, if you imagine moving kind of a box that you can predict what's inside of it, you know, it's actually pretty easy, right? You have a small box, you know, it's, you know, maybe it's a hard drive or some heavy object in it. You can kind of predict that. You know, it's going to be this heavy, and the
my 4.5-year-old son knew which presents were the Legos.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, I mean that's the estimation problem that we have to deal with. How do you actually model, you know, what the inertia or what the distribution of mass of these objects are? If you pick up a box and all the mass is in one corner, the robot may actually have a hard time holding onto it and may drop it. So, being able to quickly react to that and understand what's going on is important. And it's not just our visual sensors, right? We just don't. You know, I think actually earlier the person was talking about tactile feedback. That's a really, really important channel for trying to understand the world. And you're seeing more and more robots actually starting to work with, you know, tactile feedback and listening to kind of, you know, what your joints are doing to understand what's going on in the world.
And let me ask Jake about dealing with some of the complexity of situations. Because, Jake, I go back to what you said about telling a robot, you know, pick up the blue block from the table. And the robot scans the table and there's not a blue block at the time. Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's only a red block, or, you know, maybe there's no table. Whatever the scenario is it the same kind of situation in a factory, in a warehouse, where a robot may be told, go pick up this pallet or these packages, and those packages, for whatever reason, are not there at the time, or that pallet is not there? How good are we now? Let's talk a little bit more about understanding language and programming, and, you know, what are the hurdles now to creating this ability of robots to be able to understand complex situations and maybe respond with a question, ask the right question, or respond without even needing to ask a question and understand it. What are the barriers there?
Yeah, so I guess in that particular example, yeah. In the warehouse example, it was the robot had some misinformation, right? So it had some representation of the world and there was something inaccurate about it. So in those particular cases, it seems very reasonable that it should ask a human or some sort of centralized, like, true knowledge database to update, like, what should it be looking for and where is it actually supposed to be. So in that particular case, language, I think, may not necessarily be a fantastic solution. However, there are plenty of other examples where language is a great way for humans and robots to kind of interact with each other. In these less controlled environments, so maybe not a factory setting but more in a household, the idea is to be collaborating with people who are not robotic experts. And so having a language modality, being able to communicate with them just through English is something that essentially anyone can do. So that's the real value from my point of view in providing robots with these capabilities. So there's a lot of challenges associated with that problem, some of which may be understanding the actual speech itself and then translating that to some sort of digital signal and converting that to the actual text of the language. But then the problem that I'm focused on is actually then understanding the meaning of the text. So when you say something, how do the words relate to the environment as well as the higher level problem itself? And there are still quite a few different challenges associated with that problem that we have yet to overcome.
Right. So smart assistants are, you know, increasingly popular, right? So Amazon Echo and these other things. The interesting thing that we're working on, which is related to that problem, is not only understanding what we want to do, but what it should be doing given that. So if you ask, you know, Alexa whether or not, you know, what's the weather somewhere, that likely will be, you know, an answer. You know, it's kind of a lookup. It's a data, you know, it's a data entry somewhere, and you turn around and give the answer. If I ask the robot to pick up something off the table, there's lots of different ways it can actually solve that problem. There's consequences for getting it wrong. So that's the kind of interesting thing where we kind of diverge from kind of smart virtual assistants to actually getting robots to do things for us in the real world.
Sure. And Jake, forgive me for jumping ahead, but assuming these are problems that eventually you or people like you will be solving, will we eventually move into more complex vocal interaction with a robot where a robot will understand intonations, sarcasm, you know, those kind of, is that possible?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point. So when talking about that, when talking just about a language interaction, I typically treat language as the only thing that the robot's really thinking about. So it's trying to resolve some sentence given just the environment. But yeah, I mean, we gesture all the time, and there are things like sarcasm. These things, I think, are resolvable, but at this point,
sure,
they're not necessarily as powerful of an information source as just the direct text itself.
No, I mean, I asked that just to kind of get around in my own head, you know, what's the eventual road we're down, and is that achievable? And you think it might be resolvable?
Yeah, I mean, we're interested in looking at gestures in our lab. Primarily, my research has been focused on the language side, but we have these EMG wristbands that measure the activation potential in your muscles and can give some sort of feedback associated with the gesture that you're using at the same time. And you can associate that with the language that was being spoken during the gesture, and that might provide you some more information. A great example, I think, is when, let's say there's a table with 10 blocks on it and they all look the same, and you say, pick up that block, and you're just pointing at it. In that particular case, the pointing gesture, which is a deictic gesture, that's the term it's used, it's meant to refer to a specific object. That's the most important part of that sentence, really, is being able to resolve which object you're talking about and looking at the gesture and figuring it out.
Yeah, so machine learning has been used quite a bit recently to try to improve things like speech recognition, so being able to take, you know, freeform audio and convert it into some bit of text. I think we'll see more of using that raw audio to not only understand what they're saying, but maybe other, you know, other things that reflect their emotional state or maybe other things that are important about the person itself. So.
Okay. Alex writes to the program and just wants to know how much energy robots use and what the sources are.
Good question. So certainly, a lot of the robots in our lab are primarily, you know, electric motors, kind of traditional ways of driving them. There's been advances in some actuators to actually introduce some compliance in them as well to make them more human safe, which has been important. Certainly, there's a number of kind of interesting and exciting robotic videos of robots walking around outside and humanoid robots, which are more kind of hydraulically driven, that tend to be a little bit louder, but certainly are really dynamic. So it really is a function of what are you using the robot for, whether you want to choose, you know, electric system or hydraulic system or something, you know, maybe as a mix of the two.
I have this idea that Alex is thinking about the pallet that the robot is moving through the warehouse and hoping that the robot is very well powered. It's a fair question, Alex. I appreciate that. Go ahead, Tom.
The question of, you know, whether power is actually on the robot or not is kind of an open question in some cases. If you can actually offload the power and not carry battery packs with you, or maybe you can, in the case of, you know, lots of the, you know, space robotics, you know, they have big solar panels to recharge their own batteries. So there's lots of different ways of getting that, you know, energy, but sometimes the way you get it actually limits what you can actually do in the world, whether you can have a really, really fast dynamic system.
Yeah. We have just a few minutes left, and I want to ask our guests to kind of weigh in from their own perspective on what they think, you know, maybe some of the next interesting dominoes to fall will be based on not only the work they're doing, but what the field is doing when it comes to robots. So what's sort of on the near horizon that may be, you know, sort of achievable, Tom?
Good question. I think we're going to see more interesting things happen with mobile manipulation and mobile manipulation with teams of people. I guess I've talked in the lab about this example where if you go out with a robot that, you know, has wheels or treads or something and an end effector, and you go out with some non-expert in robotics. So say you go out with a geologist or somebody who, you know, actually just wants to make a survey of this. You have a system which is highly capable, that can do lots of different things, but it's not designed for a specific task. If that person can fluidly interact with the robot can fluidly interact with the person to communicate what it's seen, what it's observed, then I think you're going to see them used more and more kind of out in the wild. You're going to see them less in kind of a factory kind of application. Certainly at conferences and other things, we've seen them for, you know, architectural surveys and inspecting bridges, and certainly with, trying to reinspect, you know, infrastructure in America, it's going to be really important.
Yeah, very interesting. Mike Napoli, what do you think?
Sure. Yeah, I agree too. I think one of the things I'm looking forward to the most in the future is being able to interact with these robots a little bit easier. So having just the common person, somebody who's not a PhD student in robotics, being able to interface with these robots, and not just mobile robots for teams like what I'm working on and everything, but also in medical applications too. So the idea of having prosthetic hands that are robotic and being able to seamlessly interact with that, I think that's coming up. I don't think that's terribly far off. So that's one of the things I'm excited for, is to see how it affects the medical field and how it affects just basically, you know, people who are maybe injured and things like that, and be able to help them in those situations.
Yeah, in particular, developing things that are adaptable to whatever the person's preferences are. The notion that you're going to engineer a solution that will work perfectly for, you know, every person, you know, I guess is not as powerful as a system that can learn from its own experience. You know, can learn by, you know, the types of door handles people have in their houses or other types of things.
Yeah, so I think it'd be very hard to find a one-size-fits-all kind of solution, whereas something that adapts more towards the individual is much better.
Okay, so. Jake?
Yeah, I guess, so whenever I have this question, I do tend to point to the medical community. I think that there's a lot of progress there, and there's a lot of demand. And I'm very excited about things like smaller robots that do surgery from the inside so that you don't have to expose your body to any sort of external bacteria. There are some, there's a famous system, the Da Vinci, which is, it's a teleoperated surgical system. And I'm aware of a few different systems that are coming out in 2017 and 2018 that kind of build upon that. And what that does is it provides us with the opportunity to do more complicated procedures more accurately. So I think the medical field in particular is the most exciting thing for me. Prosthetics as well. So being able to provide some sort of rehabilitative device that adapts to the person as their rehabilitation improves is pretty interesting.
You heard Jake Arkin and Michael Napoli, who are PhD students, and Dr. Thomas Howard, who is a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the Department of Computer Science at the University of Rochester and the director of the Robotics and Artificial Intelligence Lab. Really interesting stuff. I want to thank all of you for being here this hour. Thanks for answering my questions and the listeners as well in our monthly Science Roundtable. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Our thanks to Kat Schwartz, the engineer, and Megan Mack as the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.